The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, a hazy Friday in Southern California, and especially hazy for the floundering Los Angeles Lakers. I'm so happy. I'm just rolling around in Celtics green and glee that the Lakers might fall apart. On the phone right now from TNT, the guy who did last night's game, and I think you've done every Lakers game, right, Steve Kerr?
Not quite all of them. I think I've done four out of the six.
Four out of the six. All right. So you go to Denver last night. Kobe's sick. And, you know, anytime Kobe gets sick, I always feel like he's tapping into the MJ flu game, which you were there for. I never know if it's 100% genuine, but he actually did seem sick. And I guess on paper, it just seemed like, yeah, the Nuggets are just going to have too much energy and roll over them and win by 20. But that's actually what happened. Were you surprised?
I was surprised, but more by the way it happened, because what I thought after game five was that the natural response from the Lakers was that Bynum and Gasol would try to post up really hard with, you know, great position and really attack and just put a ton of pressure on Denver. I mean, they were embarrassed in game five, and I thought, well, this is how it works. You know, it's the emotional response in the playoffs, and it just never came, and both guys looked totally out of it. And when that happens two games in a row in the playoffs, that's a really bad sign. So I don't know what's going on with those two guys.
Well, and then on top of that, this happened last year.
Yeah.
Same thing.
That's right.
So I don't know what's going on either. I tweeted last night, I jokingly, that Pau Gasol was saving his legs for the Olympics. But it's just weird to me. Like, Denver had so much momentum coming off of that game five. And usually, you know, you've been in this situation. You played for five title teams. Usually that's when the good team says, all right, we can't screw around anymore. Let's just take care of business and get out of here. And you always see a really good team clinch on game six in that situation. Mm-hmm. And the Lakers went the other way. They kind of rolled over. I was surprised by that. I actually thought they were going to win last night.
I thought before the series started, I thought they'd win in six, but I thought it would be, you know, the traditional tied at two and then hold serve at home, and then you go on the road and win in six. Like you said, you know, when you're threatened, that's when the really good teams go on the road and just finish it off, you know. And they looked so bad last night that I just don't know what to make of them. I think from a basketball perspective, it's really easy to see what's happened. I mean, the Laker outside shooting is non-existent, and Bynum and Gasol are getting double-teamed immediately. Like, Denver's not even waiting for a dribble or anything. They're just, as soon as the ball goes into the post, Denver sends everybody.
Yeah.
And the Lakers have nothing on the perimeter to counteract that. So Denver's just kind of, you know, when the pass is made out of the double team, they really don't have to recover. Denver doesn't. They just kind of all linger in the lane. And meanwhile, nobody really wants to shoot. You know, Blake has made a few big shots in the series, but other than that, I mean, everybody's struggling. So I think as a result, Bynum and Gasol have lost their will. You know, they're just so frustrated that they just look like they're lifeless right now.
So regardless of who wins this series, is it safe to say that maybe we can write off the Lakers here? Because Oklahoma City play the Lakers exactly like Denver did, and they have better players.
And they might not even have to, because Kendrick Perkins is probably the best post defender in the league. So you put him on Bynum and play him straight up if you want. And then you can do, you know, you can do whatever you want on the weak side, stay home with everybody, maybe make life more difficult for Kobe somehow. But, I mean, they're going to have options defensively. Denver had no options. I mean, they just had the double team. Oklahoma City's got a lot of options. So to answer your question, yeah, I mean, I would be shocked. I can't even imagine the Lakers you know, winning in the next round, much less, you know, winning a championship.
Right. It's weird. We're not even finished with round one yet, but it kind of feels like we know what the conference finals are going to be. It feels like Celtics Heat, and it feels like Oklahoma City San Antonio, and I'd be really surprised if that was the Final Four. I almost feel like there'd have to be some sort of injury to avoid that Final Four from happening. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, knock on wood, you know, because we've seen enough of that already. But yeah, that's how I see it for sure. I do think, you know, Philadelphia actually has given Boston some trouble this year.
Yep.
Doc Rivers mentioned it immediately after the game. He said it's been a track meet for those guys against us, and they blew us out a couple times. So, you know, it could be interesting. I think if Memphis can come back and beat the Clippers, I think Memphis could make it interesting against the Spurs. I don't think they would beat them again, but it's a harder matchup for San Antonio than the Clippers would be. But, yeah, that's how I see it. I think that's the Final Four right there.
Yeah, the Spurs are watching that Clipper game tonight, begging the Clippers to somehow pull that out. They want to go again. Round two, you want Blake Griffin with the sprained knee. You want to go against Chris Paul with the pulled groin, however severe that is. You want to have Reggie Evans playing big minutes. You want Vinny Del Negro involved. Like, there's just a lot going on that you want. And that Memphis team, I don't know what Lionel Hollins was doing in this series, to be honest, because it just seems like they could have pounded the Clippers down low like they did in Game 5 for the entire series, but they became like kind of, it's almost like Rudy Gay was being guarded by Nick Young and Randy Foy, basically. And it threw their whole team out of whack because they're like, well, look at that. Rudy Gay's being guarded by Randy Foy. What do we should go to that. And then Rudy Gay's not totally that kind of player, but then he's like, you're right, you should go to me. And he takes 25 shots in Game 4, which I guess he should have done, but it feels like that screwed them up. And then Game 5, they finally looked like themselves. Just pound it down low. You have Gasol and Randolph, and that's your bread and butter, and just do it.
Yeah.
And that's who they are.
I thought Game 1 was bizarre. You know, they're up 27 or whatever. I'm not sure Gasol even touched the ball in the fourth quarter until it was too late, and they just got completely out of whack. Their advantage is inside against anybody, and whether it's Randolph or Gasol, those guys are good passers. You get good offense out of them. You get penetration with the post feed, and then you can make, you know, do whatever you want. You can send cutters through, but when you revert to kind of that NBA style of, you know, that everybody plays pick and roll and ISO for your best guy, you know, Rudy Gay, well, then it just becomes easier to guard. And I thought that's what happened early in the series, and that's how they kind of let the game slip away from them.
You were a point guard when you played. You went against some of the all-time classics in your prime. You caught the tail end of Isaiah's prime. You had KJ in his heyday. You had GP in his heyday. You had Stockton second half of his heyday. You had your vicious blood feud with Stockton. It's really almost tore apart America. Where does Chris Paul, when you watch Chris Paul, I think he's the best pure point guard of all time. I don't know if he's the best point guard of all time, but I think just like from what you want from that position, he brings all of those things to the table. Where does he rank for you on that list?
It's a good question. First of all, let me clarify. I was kind of a point guard. I usually guarded the point guard, and then at the other end, I just would spot up and shoot. So I was, you know, I don't consider myself, you know, an aficionado of point guards because, you know, I was one. I just feel more like an observer, you know. But I do think that Paul has an amazing pace to his game. You know, he's not a track meet guy. He really prefers the half court. And the way he handles pick and roll, which, you know, the whole league has become about pick and roll, but I don't think I've ever seen anybody run pick and roll like Chris. Now, Nash has been probably the best of anybody in the last decade, but Chris does it differently because he uses his strength. You know, I think Kirk Heinrich described it a few years ago. He said Chris Paul is slippery strong. And if you watch him, that's kind of what it looks like. He kind of slithers into the lane. He takes all those angles. He knows where every defender is. And then he gets his guy kind of on his back or on his hip. And just with a little subtle hip move or maybe a tiny little nudge, guys just bounce off him. I mean, he is so strong. And then he's got enough space to hit that little fadeaway. And as soon as you make an adjustment, he's throwing a lob to Griffin. And it's just impossible to guard. He's amazing. I mean, he is really fun to watch.
Yeah, Nash is a good comparison. I feel like Chris is a slightly better finisher than Nash was even at his apex. Like, Nash could score in like three different ways, but Chris can just go to his, he knows what spot he wants to get to, and he just get to it every time. You know what I mean? He's just like, I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
And you guys aren't going to stop me, and I'm going to go there.
He gets wherever he wants. Nash has to be a little more deceptive to get to his spot. And Nash is a great finisher because he'll do those sort of awkward one-legged, you know, layups that he does where it's like he takes off on the wrong foot and beats the shot blocker to the punch and lays it off the backboard, and you kind of scratch your head and you go, how did he get that shot off? Paul, when he gets in there, it's more just muscle. You know, it's more he creates the angle, he gets his body in there, he elevates, and he just absorbs the contact and finishes anyway. And but the other thing I like about him, much like Nash, is just the competitiveness and the fearlessness. And you can see that. I mean, he can't wait to just put everything on his shoulders, and he embraces that. And so he's kind of got that like a combination of this incredible point guard skill to go with a, you know, a killer MJ type, Kobe type personality, which is pretty cool to watch.
When talking about like just the whole point guard position in general, like it seems like Chris and Nash figured it out pretty early. Like, get my guys involved for the entire game, and if I need to score, I'll do it in the last 4 minutes when we really need it. But for the most part, I'm going to spend the first 44 minutes just making everybody else happy. Everybody else can get theirs. And this is something Isaiah did too. And Stockton, obviously, was the all-timer. I mean, he didn't even shoot until the last 4 minutes.
Right.
Why don't more point guards do this? Like, it just seems like this is the winning formula to get everybody else involved and make them happy and then have enough confidence that you can take over at the end of the games. Why is this, like, so elusive for the point guard position?
I think it's a gift. I don't think most players see the game and see the floor like the guys you just mentioned. And it's a combination of vision and intelligence and skill. And so you see a lot of point guards these days who are incredibly dynamic scorers, you know, like a Marbury, for example, you know, could get anywhere he wanted on the floor, could shoot, but it was really more about his offense than anything. And I think guys like that don't have that same level of awareness of their teammates and of the game itself and time and score and everything else. It's more about just attack, attack, attack. And with Nash and Paul and Isaiah, I think it was more kind of game within the game too, you know, figure out what's needed and then just do it.
Yeah. You also played, we didn't mention one guy, you played against this guy, Mark Price, who ended up hurting his knee, but I think if he doesn't have that knee injury, I think he's probably in that group of the KJ Isaiah Stockton that I mentioned from that decade, right?
Yeah, I played with Mark in Cleveland for 3 years, and he was amazing. I had to guard him every day. He was the best shooter that I ever saw in the NBA. He's probably similar to Nash, although, you know, people don't really remember him that well anymore. But he was an incredible shooter, off the dribble, spot up, didn't matter. And very strong, you know, he was deceptively strong, thick legs, and could kind of get into the lane and had that runner, that one-legged runner. He was the first guy I ever saw who split the trap on the pick and roll. Now everybody does it.
Back then, nobody sliced right through it. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. He was the first guy that did that.
Pick and roll and maybe attack the big guy, but he was the first guy who would just split it and do that little, you know, crossover, that really low crossover, and then either go all the way to the rim or shoot the runner. And so I think Mark, in many ways, sort of paved the way for for guys like Nash and Chris Paul.
Were you on the 92 Caps? The team last year?
We beat Boston in seven. In this
Price made a
come on.
He made a play that broke my heart in game four. We're up four. Bird had like the 25-pound back brace on at that point. Like it was just no business playing a recreational league game, much less a playoff game. And somebody made a basket. We're up four with like a minute left. And if we win that game, we go up 3-1 in the series, and we're gonna win.
Yep.
You know, because and they inbound it to Price, and it was like he just knew, like, I have to score in the next 10 seconds or we're going to lose this entire series. And he just went full court and dribbled through five guys and just – it was a classic, this right now is my time. I have to win the game here. And he did it, and then they ended up winning overtime. But I can still see him going full court, knowing exactly what he was going to do, and just they couldn't stop it.
I love the fact that you remember that, and I have no recollection.
I think I noticed last night you screwed up. You said you were talking about the Game 1 Memorial Day Massacre, and you were like, what was that, 87, 86? I'm like, come on, Kurt, it was 85.
It was 85.
I was getting mad. Yeah, well, you were playing. I was sitting there watching
and
all this stuff.
Marv took such great joy in correcting me. Any time I get something wrong, Marv just loves to correct me on the air.
So – that Denver crowd last night, what's the best crowd that you've seen in the playoffs this year? Because that crowd seemed pretty good last night.
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, not even close. I love the playoffs because there's always kind of, if you can do or watch, you know, several of the games as the series goes on, you can just kind of feel the momentum shift, not just with the players, but with the fans. And, you know, I did game four in Denver, and it was kind of a, gosh, you know, I hope we can win type crowd. And last night, it was like we sense blood. You know, we smell blood type crowd. I mean, they knew that they could win the series, and they kind of helped their team along all night. And, it's cool to see, and especially in a place like Denver that, you know, has had some success but a lot of heartbreak, and they've never gotten over the hump. In the NBA playoffs, really. And this is like the team that really shouldn't be doing it because they've had better teams the last few years. But it's a really likable group of guys, and they play hard, and George Karl's amazing. And the fans, I think, in Denver are just so excited right now. They sense it. They feel like they're gonna win tomorrow.
I was shocked by how good the Clipper crowds were in games three and four. I was actually proud. I was proud of these, you know, because the Clippers get this reputation as a little bandwagon-y, and you go to Clipper games because you can't afford the Laker tickets and stuff like that. And they were really loud. I felt like they affected both games. It's going to be interesting in game six, you know, because you talked about how crowds can assume different identities.
Yeah.
And I think tonight's crowd is going to be that skittish, I hope Chris and Blake are okay. You know, it has a potential to go that way where you're just kind of nervous. That's what happened to the Celtics crowd. The Celtics crowd was out for blood last night, and then the fourth quarter. Oh, you didn't see the game because you're doing the Laker game.
Right. I saw bits and pieces.
It was so clear in the fourth quarter that the Celts were just running on fumes of their fumes.
Yeah.
You know, it was basically KG was playing great, but Pierce couldn't move. Ray couldn't move. Bradley's playing with one arm. Rondo didn't totally have it, and the crowd just got scared.
Yeah,
you know, and you can feel it when that happens. So I like that point about the identities.
Yeah, the Clips fans will be that way tonight for sure because it's hard to see them going back to Memphis and winning a game seven. I mean, this is the one they have to get, and your two best players are hurting, and it's like almost like the Grizzlies figured something out last game and kind of broke through a little bit, and it just. I mean, I'm not a Clippers fan. I mean, I don't cheer for either team, but just as an impartial observer, it doesn't feel great, you know.
Right.
Going into tonight, it's I'd be very nervous.
And then you have the Philly crowd last night, which was more of a, I can't believe we just made the second round. 40 things had to happen. This is unbelievable. Let's celebrate this. Like, it was almost like they won the title.
Yeah, well, they're in that honeymoon stage where Oklahoma City and Chicago were, you know, kind of the last couple of years where the fans are just so excited for any success.
Yeah,
and that's always kind of the trend in the NBA, or not the trend, but just sort of the phase. You know, you get a young team, you're good enough to get to the playoffs. The first year, it's like, hey, we made the playoffs. The next year, it's all right. We got to win a round. Then you want to move to the, you know, further along. But sooner or later, the honeymoon ends, and I think the honeymoon is kind of over for Chicago and Oklahoma City. And it's probably right in the middle of it for Philadelphia. But that's usually the most fun stage, you know, to be in as a fan and as a team, because there's not that much pressure, and you're just so excited to finally be doing well, and the expectations aren't that high. It's kind of a good spot to be in.
Yeah, I remember the 2002 Celtics, which was the first Pierce-Antoine playoff year. Jim O'Brien, Patino has left. I don't think we'd made the playoffs for like 8 years. And the fans were just so grateful to be going to playoff games and just to hear the building be loud. Like, it almost, we didn't care what happened.
Right.
You know, and then on top of that, we won one or two rounds. But
where do you think the Laker crowd will be tomorrow night? I mean, I can't wait to be in the building. And they have to be so disgusted with their team right now.
Yes.
So, I sense that my guess is, and you give me your answer, but my guess is they will turn on the team quickly if they don't get off to a good start.
Oh, that's interesting. See, I always found, like, here's a good example. 1990 Celtics-Knicks. We win the first two, Knicks win the next two, and then game five was that game when the Knicks, you know, Ewing made the three in the corner,
yeah,
and they just finished us off. You were probably playing. I don't remember this, but
I remember the game. Sure, he hit that corner three right in front of the bench, right?
Ewing, right. Yeah. And as that game went, Bird missed a dunk with like 10 minutes to go that he just never normally would have missed, and it was kind of like the symbolic end of the big three era. Like, it was clear the '80s were now over, and the crowd just got kind of catatonic. And that's what I wonder if the Laker fans, like, if they fall behind by eight tomorrow and Kobe misses, like, two straight threes and it's just clear the energy's not there, I don't think they'll boo. I think they'll just get kind of quiet and weird, because that was my experience with when it happened with the Celtics.
See, I think they'll boo because they booed in game five when the Lakers were really stinking it up in the middle of the
game. That's a good point.
And then I was so disappointed in Bynum and Gasol, not just the performance, but just the lack of energy and the lack of spirit and fight, that I think that's what fans want to see more than anything. Obviously you want to win, but when you see your guys in a huge situation not fighting, that just drives you nuts as a fan.
And yeah.
I think there's a lot of pressure on those two guys, on Bynum and Gasol in particular. Because of what happened in Dallas last year, you know, Gasol had a lousy series. Bynum embarrassed the franchise with that clothesline of Barea.
Yeah,
they have a lot to atone for in tomorrow night's game. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Well, and also could possibly be the last games that they play in Laker uniforms, both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we already know they tried to trade Gasol once, and I just think he's the logical guy because we know they get multiple pieces for him. And then I just the Bynum Howard trade to me just feels like that's going to I just feel like that happens this summer.
Yeah.
It's the logical trade. And I don't see how Orlando can do better than Bynum. Bynum
right.
Maybe needs a fresh start. He could talk himself into the whole Kobe was holding me back thing. You know, I need my own team. All like the foolish stuff people say. and if you're the Lakers and you turn Pyle into multiple pieces and then somehow get Dwight, I mean, that's a pretty nice reset button.
Yeah, oh, it'd be huge. Because
so.
You're both guys would be on the rebound, you know, so to speak. And I think both guys would have a lot to prove. But yeah, that would seem to be the most logical move, for Orlando. And if you're LA, if you get bounced, particularly if you lose now to Denver, then I would think a shakeup is coming.
Yeah, I want to make one more Laker point. I don't know if you guys have hammered this home enough, but you know, Ramon Sessions, everybody was so excited. Oh, they finally have a point guard. Like, there's a reason Ramon Sessions is bounced around. He can't guard anybody.
Right.
He's been a huge liability for them in this Denver series because either point guard has been able to do basically whatever they want against the Laker point guards. Offensively, yeah, he's been pretty good, and I think fans fall into the habit sometimes of they watch what somebody does on offense, and they forget that mm-hmm. you're supposed to play on both sides of the court. I think he's really hurt them in this series.
Yeah, this is a bad matchup for him because, first of all, it's hard to be a point guard defender on the Lakers anyway because you know you're going to be put into 1,000 pick and rolls because everybody wants to put Bynum and Gasol on the perimeter in pick and roll situation and make those guys cover ground. And then the other reason it's a bad matchup is because offensively he really can't penetrate and get to the rim because the Lakers are so worried about tempo that if when your point guard gets caught like shooting floaters and runners in the lane and he doesn't make them, it's against Denver, it's a layup the other way. So the Lakers are kind of running all their stuff through, they're trying to anyway, through Kobe and through the post. And so you're not really seeing Sessions' best offensive game, you know, which is yeah. that high pick and roll. So this is a lousy matchup for him. But overall, I mean, yeah, he's not a great defender, and he hasn't done that much to help their perimeter defense.
JaVale McGee, you were a GM as recently as 2 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, no, he was we worked him out in Phoenix, and we passed on him. We took Robin Lopez at 14, and then I think McGee went 16.
Oh, I think I should make fun of you in a column for that.
Yeah, hey, feel free. I could be in your next GM summit.
Well, were you one of the teams that passed on him because you were worried about his mom? Because I know for a fact that there were a couple teams that were scared off by the mom.
You know, we were scared off, I think, just by just how raw he was, and there's no doubt about his talent.
Yeah.
You know, just watching him run and jump was pretty remarkable. We felt like we needed somebody who could step right in because we had an older team, one that we felt was still pretty good.
Yeah,
and
reliable.
Robin, yeah, and Robin was much more ready to play, and he could make a shot. The other two guys that we looked at and we worked them all out were DeAndre Jordan and McGee with Robin. And Robin can make that little 17-footer.
Yeah.
And he's just, you know, he's nastier than the other guys. The other guys were really, really young and immature. And I know where this conversation is inevitably leading to, which is the Granlund piece with
right.
You know, with the kids coming in at such a young age and the evaluation process and all that. But for us, you know, it's Robin really helped us get. We got to the conference finals that year. He averaged like 15 a game in the series against the Lakers. He did a great job. Now he's regressed a little bit and he's playing behind Gortat and DeAndre and McGee look like better players now definitely more potential and more athletic ability. But it's. You know, you can go through those stories every single year in the draft,
yeah.
for sure.
I'd rank DeAndre third, actually. I think he's really regressed this year. But the thing with JaVale, and I'd be interested to know if you did this when you were running a team, he always seemed like he was on the wrong team. And I think, like, if you just look at the history of, all right, how did that team steal player X? It always seems to be, you look at, like, Marcus Camby or Tyson Chandler, guys like that. Situation where a guy who was young on a young team just was in the wrong situation. And anytime I saw Washington play, I always thought he played hard. And his
yeah.
arms were just like, you were staggered by how long his arms were.
Yeah.
He was really like almost like freakish.
Yeah.
And I would always watch him go, man, I wonder what'll happen. I don't know what'll happen, but I wonder what'll happen if he finds the right team. It does seem like he's found the right team. Now you look at this the Denver GM, the new guy, and some of the trades he's made. I think he's got to be in the top five right now for the moves.
Yeah, Masai Ujiri. First of all, he's a great guy. He's very humble and smart and classy. But I think they've done an incredible job there. When you go back to when Carmelo was still there. And how they handled that trade and what they've done since. He's made a lot of really good moves. And I think there is a market out there for guys like McGee because of the current situation in college basketball where guys are one and done. There's a market for, you know, a J.J. Hickson guy or, or McGee guy, somebody who maybe comes in too soon but is really gifted and can't figure it out. But if you've got the right pieces around him, then, maybe the second time around he can develop.
You know who else is like that? Tyreek Evans.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if he's going to be the best or the second best player in a really good team, but I know that he's been in a really bad situation the last couple of years. I know
right.
he's talented. I know that from what I've seen, he's not a dog.
Right.
I don't think he really knows how to play basketball, but I also know that with the skills that he has and what they're asking from him, that just was kind of the wrong team for him.
Yeah,
and maybe
I agree.
He goes to another team and, let's say it's a good team says to him, hey, Tyreek, will you be our rational confidence guy off the bench and score 20? Just you come in 25 minutes a game and you just shoot as many times as you want. We don't care.
Yeah.
Like, he could be kind of devastating.
Well, one thing I've always said is that bad players have no role players. Bad teams have no role players. So if you're on a lousy team, you don't know who you are and it's hard to figure it out. But when you go to a good team, the roles are defined very clearly and a really good coach can help you find your niche. Tyson Chandler bounced around for a while, until he kind of figured out who he was and I think that there are guys out there like that who just need to be in the right situation so they can figure out who they are. And I go back to the guys coming out so young, so gifted, but they haven't had a chance to figure all that stuff out. And so everything becomes very circumstantial. You really need the right coach and the right teammates, even if you're really gifted, guys like Tyreek or McGee. I mean, they need, McGee needed George Karl and he needed Andre Miller. And now that he's got it, I think he's got a much better chance of really developing.
We published your piece about the one and done rule, I think, on Tuesday. In case anybody hasn't read it who's listening, Steve thinks that they should push it from 19 years to 20. What kind of feedback did you get?
Mostly positive. I had a lot of college coaches contacted me and were really pleased that I had sort of put that out there. And really the piece had nothing to do with college ball. I mean, that's a whole different angle to take and a very important one. But I just wanted to kind of cut through the clutter of all the different arguments and just say, look, this is about the NBA. This is about business. And if they feel like they can put a better product on the floor by, putting this rule in, and they can do it with the consent of the union, then they ought to do it because it'll make for a better league. But I received more comments from college people than NBA people.
An idea that readers kept sending in to me that it was kind of a variation on what you were proposing. What if players weren't allowed to enter the league until they were 20, but they could get drafted at any point out of high school? So, for instance, let's say Shabazz, who's the guy UCLA got. I think he's the number two guy. He's in the draft this year. But you don't get him for 2 years. But he's in the draft this year and can go at any point. Would you be in favor of that, or is that too radical?
It's a really interesting thought, and I'd have to give it more thought personally. My first reaction is that it wouldn't be great for the league in terms of marketing. Like, if you're Washington this year and you win the lottery and your fans are sitting there going, all right, who are we going to take? And you take Shabazz and you got to wait 2 years and you watch him play in the D League. I think that they would be excited, but at the same time, they're like, we got to wait 2 years for this guy,
Right.
So from a marketing standpoint for the league, probably not great. It would serve some purpose though in hastening the developmental process, and it would put more emphasis on the D League and how teams controlled their minor league affiliations and all that stuff, and that would be good. That's something to think about.
Well, here's my counter to that. Rubio, who didn't come into the league for 2 years and strangely became like this beacon of hope for the Minnesota fans. Their team was terrible. They're like, hey, we have Rubio coming. Like, maybe it would almost, like, let's say Charlotte had taken, Anthony Davis last year with their lottery pick. And now he's going to play one more year in Kentucky, and then he's going to the Bobcats. We know for a fact. If I'm a Charlotte fan, I'm feeling a lot better than I am right now, right? Where I'm going to the lottery with my fingers crossed.
Okay, I guess I misunderstood you. So you're saying you can get drafted and then go to college anyway?
Yeah. You go to college.
I thought you meant get drafted and play in the D League or you know, play in a developmental league before you move on to
No. I'm saying you get drafted, but you still have to go 2 years to college.
Ah, I got it. What's the point then? Like that gets really tricky with the NCAA because if you get drafted, you can't get paid if you want to play in the NCAA. So a player gets drafted and a team just holds his rights. I'm not sure I understand the value in it. You know,
that's where this gets radical.
Yeah,
the guy can get paid. What if the guy can get paid? What if they have some sort of arrangement like this guy's in college, but he's a first round pick and he gets, it's like a stipend. Those 2 years.
You want to be the one to call Mark Emmert in the NCAA? You want to take that to them?
He doesn't get paid in college. He gets paid after. After he finishes the 2 years, he gets the money that's been put in some saving area. It's probably.
All right. Well, my reaction to that is David Stern would want no part of that because they've got to keep it as clean as possible.
Yeah.
And just keep it about them. And whatever happens with the college game, it will. I think the college game would benefit with the rule for sure. I think everybody is in agreement of that. But if you're Stern and you're the league, I wouldn't mess with the NCAA rules. I would just stick to the NBA's business.
The other one people were saying was like how baseball does it. I think you mentioned it a little bit in your column, but if there was a way that you could either draft the guy right out of high school, so it would basically only be somebody who was you just knew was 100% ready. Like it would be the equivalent of LeBron, Dwight Howard, people like that. And if that guy wasn't a top 15 pick, then he has to sit out 2 years and cannot re-enter the draft until after his sophomore year.
Yeah. I don't like that one that much. To me, the whole point of this is to get guys who are more prepared. And, you know, I pointed out in the article that even the guys who are the best players in the NBA right now, you know, Kobe, Garnett, LeBron, you know, Dwight Howard, they did fine their first year or two, but none of them won. Not one of those guys really won, you know, until it was, you know, a few years into their careers.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Magic, Bird, Barkley, you know, Michael, all those guys were competing for national championships their first couple of years in college, and then they were competing for NBA championships almost immediately in the NBA. In Bird's case, what did the Celtics go from? Went 26 wins to 61 his rookie year?
Yeah, it was like 29 to 60, something like that. Yeah, it was the biggest jump in NBA history.
So they take a 30-game jump. Magic Johnson wins the NBA title as a rookie. So that's kind of my point is that, you know, this is about the NBA getting, you know, prepared players coming into the league. Even the stars, you know, even the guys like LeBron who put up big numbers his rookie year, he wasn't ready to win. And I just think the league would be stronger if they had guys who were ready to play but also ready to win.
And, you know, you left out one guy in that you're doing all these examples for the people who are better off staying. And maybe you mentioned him briefly, but I think Wade's a really good example of this.
Mm-hmm.
Wade was in college for 3 years and became a significantly better player over those 3 years. Goes into the NBA. His first year, Miami has that, you know, they were the classic really good young team that overachieved, and they took somebody to this. I think they even may have won round one. And it became clear that he was going to be a special player. That summer, they pulled the Shaq trade off. They probably would have made the finals the next year if he didn't get hurt in the Eastern Conference Finals. But, like, he was ready to start winning right away. And that's to your point. These guys that come out right away like LeBron did or even after a year like Carmelo or Durant, they're not ready to win right away.
Yeah. No, Wade is a perfect example. And then, you know, I went on a radio show the other day, and the host brought up Jermaine O'Neal and said, you know, that would have been a good example for your article, kind of from a different angle, which I totally agreed with. And his point was, Portland drafts O'Neal. They develop him for 3 years, and then he becomes a star for the Pacers. So, you know, the Blazers, and they traded him to the Pacers, I think, for Dale Davis. But basically, yeah. The Blazers paid Jermaine O'Neal probably, you know, I don't know, close to $10 million, maybe more. And he never really was a factor for them. And by the time he was ready to go, he became a star for a different team. So a lot of these teams are paying millions of dollars to develop these players when historically the colleges, you know, they did it for free and very, very happily so, I might add.
Right.
So,
well, the Celtics.
It's good business. It would be good business for the NBA. And that's my point. I'm not taking any moral stance or ethical stance. I just think that it's not the NBA's responsibility to provide employment for teenagers. It's just not.
And the Celtics, they did basically the same thing with Al Jefferson. They developed him for 3 years and then they traded him.
And you can say that they developed an asset and they got Garnett out of it,
yeah.
And whatever, and that's true. But you know, there's a lot of different arguments. I think people generally make fair points, no matter what side of the argument you're on. But the point of the article for me was just trying to cut through all the clutter and just say, look, this is about the NBA. They're the ones who control it. The NCAA doesn't. The NBA controls it with the union. And if they want to do it, they should do it.
Well, and then the other key point I thought you made was that just from a scouting, just trying to assess who's good and who's not coming out of college, all you're doing is increasing the margin of error by the fact that you aren't able to see these guys enough. You know, and it just makes it so much harder to know. You know, I think the JaVale McGee, Robin Lopez example is a really good example.
Right.
If JaVale McGee's in college for 2 years, you have a much better feel on how he's going to adjust in the NBA than you do if you're just basically throwing dice against a wall and picking him 16th.
For sure. And you know, the cynic will say, yeah, but people screw up all the time anyway in the draft, even with guys who are in school for 3 years. And that's true. But that's kind of the point. It's such a hard process. It's such an inexact science. You know, the quote I used was from Jerry West, who once said, you know, if you're right more than half of the time in scouting, then you're doing a good job. Because it's just really tricky. And so if you get an extra year to watch a guy, I think it's not going to solve everything, but it will increase your chances of being right. And that means a lot to the NBA in terms of putting quality teams on the floor and making the right financial decisions.
And I like the point you made in that piece about when you go to college, sometimes the relationships you have become, you know, as important, if not more important, than what you got out of college in terms of how it helped you as a basketball player. You know, and you pointed out you saw the guys three different generations from the same. What university was it?
It was Michigan State.
Michigan State, three different generations of guys who are all hanging out, and that's what you miss when you go right into the NBA, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I played at Arizona, and even now, to this day, when I see an Arizona guy out there, I saw Jordan Hill last week. I was doing a Laker game, and I've known him now for, you know, 10 years since he was at Arizona, and we've been at the same school functions or whatever, and so all of a sudden, you know, you got this history of, you know, I came to Arizona in 83. He got to Arizona probably, I don't know, you know, 2005 or something. We've got this connection, and the connection holds with, you know, guys across, spanning that entire generation and beyond. I mean, you know, Luke Walton and Richard Jefferson and Mike Bibby. I see all these guys, and it's like, hey, we're part of the same club. And it's kind of a cool thing. It develops a kind of a bond and a sense of identity. And so I thought that was really cool when I saw the Michigan State guys. It was Steve Smith, Draymond Green, and Mateen Cleave. And they were just hanging out, and I just thought it was really cool. And that's something that's important in the game. It's not just a neat, like, relationship thing. It's important to how you play basketball. And I think that's that would be emphasized a little bit more if you had to stay for a couple of years.
We ran an article last week by Jonathan Abrams about Tyson Chandler and Eddie Curry. It's basically
I read it.
The same
yeah, it was
thing.
Great.
It was like fork in the road. Chandler went one way, Curry went the other way, but that's what happens when you're pulling these guys right out of college. And I think if you, the most interesting thing the league could do if they really were serious about changing this would be to talk to the teammates of the people who have played with guys like Gerald Green and Eddie Curry, like these guys when they were 18 and 19 and just how ill-equipped they were to handle the everyday life of just being a professional athlete.
Yeah.
It's just, I know I couldn't have done it. When I was a freshman in college, I could barely get to class.
No way. No way.
And you just have such like a bad idea of what's responsible and what's not, you know?
Right, right. And it's, I mean, you think about what it means, you know, obviously from a business standpoint for the NBA, but how about from a personal standpoint for a lot of these guys? Just, you know, what it means to their future. I mean, whether it's, you know, maybe blowing money or just ending up with some bad advice or whatever. I mean, I understand the argument that college isn't for everybody, but I can't imagine somebody going to school for 2 years and not benefiting from it. You may not be the greatest student in the world, but you just, it's life experience. You know, it's development at an age where, you know, you're kind of going from being a kid to being a man. And when you skip that part of the process and you're all of a sudden playing in a man's league, there's a lot that can go wrong.
When you did you read the Greg Oden piece we ran this week?
I did. I read it today, yeah.
When you read that, you know, you ran an organization, and it's my opinion that the Blazers failed him to at least some degree. I think, obviously he rushed himself back too soon. You can't blame him for him not being more candid about how his body was feeling, and he ends up getting hurt two more times. But at the same time, that's a franchise that rushed Brandon Roy back in a playoff series against you when you were playing them right. In the first round, and clearly, you know, it's had a lot of turmoil and different GM stuff like that. When you read that, did you kind of feel like, man, I just wish he had ended up on the right organization? Or did you just feel like it was a fluke that he got hurt that many times?
I felt like it was a fluke, and you know, it's always hard anytime there's a medical issue and you don't have access to all the information. It's so hard to speculate and say, you know, boy, they brought him back too early or whatever, because you don't really know from the outside. It just seemed to me like more of a fluke than anything. I mean, it seemed like he was predisposed to these injuries, and I'm not sure the Blazers could have done anything differently. Maybe they could have, but it's, you know, it's probably not my place to speculate on that.
At the same time, you know the magic of the Phoenix Suns training staff. What do you think the odds are that they could have salvaged him or that they can salvage him? Just from what you know.
I would, you know, anytime we had a situation where we were thinking about trading for a player or, you know, drafting a guy, I would just go to them and I would ask them. And I would say, hey, you know, what do you guys think? Can this guy be salvaged? What's, you know, and they would do assessments. They would watch him on tape, but you know, if they could get their hands on him, they'd put him through a series of tests, and you know, sometimes they'd come to me and say, hey, we can do this. You know, this guy is lacking in these areas and we can fix that stuff, or you know, there's not a whole lot you can do about that one. Like the DeJuan Blair stuff, you know, we were interested in him, and he had two torn ACLs, or I guess didn't have any ACLs.
Right,
and
he's missing.
You know, that was just the one that it's like, now you really can't do much about that, and so he's going to wear out pretty quickly. And do you really want to, you know, use a first round high pick on him? But there's, you know, it's always individual cases. It's just, you know, you look at it and you get the experts' eyes on it and they tell you what they think. And the Phoenix guys they're the best. They're amazing. So I always had great trust and faith in them.
Last question. James Harden, what he did on Saturday night against Dallas, I thought, for me personally, changed the complexion of what I'm expecting from these playoffs. I always felt like Oklahoma City was just going to flame out because when they were missing jump shots, that was it. There was no plan B. Now here's Harden, who really seems like he's blossoming into something a level higher than maybe I thought he was going to be. And there's your plan B. Clear out, and James Harden will get to the rim and create shots for people. Did that change how you feel about these playoffs?
I feel like they're on a collision course with San Antonio, and I think it could be an epic series, assuming it, you know, it develops. I just feel like the Spurs are having this magical season. I love their team. I think it could be possibly the best Spurs team that they've had, and I know that sounds crazy because Duncan is beyond his prime, and so is Ginobili, but the way they shoot, the depth, the chemistry, it's just amazing to watch. And Pop has done an incredible job adapting to, you know, the way the game is played these days. When you watch Denver and L.A. and nobody can make a shot, and then you watch the Spurs and they got like 10 guys who are raining threes from all over, and Tony Parker's just carving people up, it's hard not to see San Antonio just rolling through people. But then you watch Oklahoma City with those big three and the way they attack off the dribble. And I just think it could be just an epic series between those two teams. I think they're far and away the best two teams in the West. And I also think they would both give Miami a lot of trouble.
So, yeah, I know how you feel.
You're looking for a prediction.
No. You just put Miami in the finals. It kind of hurt my feelings.
Oh, sorry about that.
You just kind of skipped over.
I think Boston would have a chance. Philly can't beat Miami. Boston, but they have to be healthy. Pierce and Allen have to be healthy.
That's the thing.
But I do like the way they've matched up with Miami, particularly with Bradley out there and his ability to guard Wade, and then Garnett playing center, opening up the floor. You know, Rondo carving them up. That could be a great series, too, but if Boston has to be healthy.
Yeah, and that's the problem. If you told me that I had a 100% healthy Boston team heading into that series, I would think that we were going to win the series. But you just look at what happened last night. Pierce is playing on one leg.
Yeah.
Bradley's playing one-handed. Ray Allen can't walk. And it just, you know, Steensma, who I can't believe I'm saying this, but was a key part of this team down the stretch. Now you got Ryan Hollins out there because Steensma is pretty banged up. And Ryan Hollins wasn't on the Celtics 6 weeks ago. My worst case scenario is just going to that Miami series with this banged up Celtics team that's just going to get annihilated. So hopefully if they can make it past Philly but also get healthy. I don't know if those two things can happen at the same time, but that's their only chance.
I think if it did, I think the NBA would be in for a real treat with those two matchups. If it were, you know, San Antonio Thunder and then Boston Miami, I mean that would be if all four teams were healthy and playing at their usual level, that would be amazing basketball to watch.
All right, Steve Kerr, you're doing tomorrow night. You're doing tomorrow night, right?
Yeah, Game 7 at Staples. I can't wait.
8 o'clock. I cannot go because it's date night. I'm so humiliated.
What?
On a number. Yeah, it's terrible. I'm going tonight to the Clippers, and I've been at the Staples Center so much lately that my wife was like, look, we're having a date on Saturday night. Tape the game. And I can't afford to get divorced, Steve Kerr. I just can't.
That's a good call. Let me ask you this: when you TiVo a game, do you have my son and I have an expression? My oldest, who's a huge sports fan, we have an expression. We call it TiVo discipline. Do you have TiVo discipline, or do you have to check your phone for the scores?
If it's a Boston team, I have to check the phone. I just can't live in the alternate reality where the game hasn't happened yet. And I'm getting too many texts and emails.
It's like you can't even go out, and you got to keep your phone off, and it's a tough thing to accomplish.
Stay off Twitter, like the whole thing. But Lakers-Denver, I might be able to avoid the score. It's possible. Right. So anyway, say hi to Mar for us. Good luck tomorrow night.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.